your appellate counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Come forward, introduce yourself, and there's any argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Bernard Lands, and I represent Donald Wolf, the appellant in this case.
Anyone reserve any time for rebuttal?
3 minutes. The trial court ruled as a matter of law that there was no forbearance agreement and that there was no acknowledgement of the debt, and therefore granted the motion for summary judgment in favor of the appellee here. And there were, however, multiple questions of fact that the court should have not taken upon itself to decide without letting the jury decide, because multiple inferences could be inferred from these facts that there was a forbearance agreement and possibly an acknowledgement of the debt. With regards to the contractual forbearance agreement, during the course of negotiating the contract with Mr. Wolf and his mother, he told his mother in a letter, CP 193 and CP 053, that is undated, that I have no plans whatsoever to foreclose on the contract at any time, which is why I have not asked for anything in writing in that area, which is customary on most types of contracts. This was in the context of the default provisions in the contract and the payment of a default fee, but nothing else was really discussed, as far as I can tell, from that letter, other than the fact he told his mother that he wouldn't foreclose on her during the life of the contract because she had previously had problems with houses, having lost at least one house to foreclosure, which necessitated her moving on to defendant Wolf's property to live the rest of her life, which turned out to be approximately 20 years before she went to a nursing home.
So the last payment appears to have been made sometime in 2000, and there was the bankruptcy in 2003. How do you calculate the running of the statute of limitations? What's your
six years from the date of the bankruptcy petition and the discharge thereafter, because in that proceeding, the debtor, Barbara Harrington, acknowledged the debt again. It was in her Chapter 7 Individual Debtor's Statement of Intention, CP 088.
How is a statement of intent an affirmation of a debt when the federal rules require a written instrument?
And that's true. The federal rules do require even more than that, to be brought into court and have the judge explain to you the consequences of reaffirming the debt.
And does the judge have to approve the affirmation?
Judge has to approve the affirmation.
Was there any approval of any affirmation?
No, there wasn't.
So how's that an acknowledgement of the debt?
The acknowledgement of a debt doesn't have to go through the strict confines of an acknowledgement in a bankruptcy court proceeding.
Well, and aren't you frustrating the whole purpose of the bankruptcy code if there's a backdoor way to get to the same place without the procedural protections of the bankruptcy code?
Well, the backdoor way there may be, if you want to call it that, is the acknowledgement
of that debt. You can call it
a window
if you want, but if the federal code sets forth a way to have a debt affirmed, and noncompliance with that doesn't prevent the argument that it has been affirmed, what's the use of the procedure?
Well, the use of the procedure is if you reaffirm dischargeable debts. And the debt we're talking about in this case was a non-dischargeable debt because it was secured by real property.
Well, that doesn't make the debt non-dischargeable. It just keeps the security available for the debt. There's no personal liability.
No, that's the point. There is no personal liability upon the discharge of the debtor in this bankruptcy proceeding. But that doesn't wipe out the debt as to the property. The property is still subject to the debt and can be foreclosed to recover on that debt.
And how does that help you in an acknowledgement argument?
Because the acknowledgement was that the debt still existed, that it was made under the terms and conditions that Mr. Wolf recited in his declaration, that he was going to wait until his mother died to foreclose on that instrument, which was the security in the property that she lived upon for like 18 years.
So are you more relying on the forbearance agreement than on the reaffirmation of debt? Because if it was 6 years after the bankruptcy, that would be 2009 or 2010, and the action wasn't filed until 2014. So I'm trying to figure out how it isn't past the statute of limitations.
Well, with reference to that, I would say that the debt was again acknowledged in the letter in 2009, wherein she stated that Don, her son, had agreed to take $12,000 for the property.
That's that handwritten document.
The handwritten document.
So for us to rule in that way, we would have to find that to be the reaffirmation?
That would have to be the acknowledgement of the debt.
Acknowledgement of the debt, okay.
And then 6 years from 2009, we're within. And the written acknowledgement that you're referring to only has to recognize the existence of a debt, be communicated to a creditor with the intention that it be communicated to the creditor, and not indicate an intention not to pay.
Does the communication have to be contemporary with the execution of the document?
Well, in this case, I believe it was designed to attach to her will.
You're not answering my question.
Well,
is there a case that says it has to be contemporaneous with the execution of the document?
No.
Is there a case that says it doesn't have to be?
No, not that I've seen.
So that's an unsettled question.
As far as I can tell.
So I could put a letter to a creditor in my safety deposit box with instructions to be opened at the time of my death, and I survived for 7 years after I put that letter in there. That could be an acknowledgement that would satisfy the tolling of the statute of limitations.
I don't see why it wouldn't be. It satisfies all the other requirements, assuming so in your hypothetical. And it was designed, I believe, by his mother. I don't have any real evidence of it other than the letter itself to happen just like you said it happened. She designed it to give to a lady. She witnessed it in front of this lady, signed it in her presence, and attached it to her will. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. You'll have 3 minutes for about it.
Thanks.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is Brian Hannes, representing the respondent in this matter. First thing I'd like to address is the forbearance issue. Forbearances are pretty much another contract. They require all the provisions of a contract. The evidence that we see in this case does not show a forbearance. We show what Mr. Wolf wanted to do, what he liked to do, which all works out great for him, if that was the case. The fact that he prepared that letter saying, I have no intent to do that, does not create a forbearance. It just simply says, hey, make the payments, we're not going to have any problems. He was more concerned about making sure payments did happen.
Well, since it would be to her favor that the forbearance agreement was done, presumably, wouldn't that be a question of fact for a trier of fact as opposed to a question of law at summary judgment?
Well, I think part of the problem is no, I don't believe it's a question of fact. First of all, unfortunately, Ms. Harrington's not here to answer her understanding of what that meant. And second of all we have as evidence, the only evidence we have, is a letter that was prepared by Mr. Wolf. We don't have anything from Ms. Harrington saying, hey, yeah, sure, I agree to that. That's wonderful. Thanks. We have nothing. There is no dispute of fact on that point. We have his intent that did not create a contract or a forbearance. So I don't believe that meets the threshold of a dispute of fact that would set this off to a jury. So
what about the acknowledgement that has been referred to, the handwritten acknowledgement attached to the will?
The first thing I would say with looking at the acknowledgement, I think you have to, well, I wouldn't call it an acknowledgement, of course, but looking at that letter, it's a letter. It's more like, to me, a journal. What had happened is it was attached to the will after the fact when the case was filed. They didn't know really, but when you read, this is the point I'm making, is when you read the entire document, I see it more of, this is my life. But I don't see that statement alone meeting the requirements of acknowledgement. It says, Don agreed to take, indicating, okay, he agreed to some money at some point, which is $13,000, $17,000, not clear. But then you look at the outside evidence that supports that. She paid him $17,000. To me, that shows that, yeah, at this point in my life, this happened. She also talks about in other writings how she's mad that Don forced her into this agreement, that she had no choice, and she was not going to pay him anymore. She had a letter about 2002 or 2003, I can't remember, sorry, where she said, my lawyer told me to quit paying him and for to let him sue me. She files bankruptcy, and I'll get into the bankruptcy point here in a second, but she files bankruptcy, says, I owe this money, does not sign a reaffirmation agreement. So I don't think that letter meets the acknowledgement. Like Your Honor asked, can it be contemporaneously at some point? Yes, it can, but I still think it has to meet the threshold of, first of all, stating what the debt is, an intent to pay it, or an intent for that message to be portrayed to the creditor. I don't think that statement meets it. I think she's just more making a statement of fact of something that happened in her life along with the rest of that document.
Is that the only inference that can be drawn from that statement, or can the competing inference that counsel has urged also be drawn from it?
Well, I think anybody can make any inference they want from a statement. Now, sure, would that create
a competing inference a reasonable one?
Yeah, I think there could be a reasonable inference from that. Sure, I shouldn't say that because it's against my client, but I think anybody can make that reasonable inference. But I think other factors come into play, which makes it not an inference and not a dispute of fact. For example, bankruptcy. The bankruptcy is a huge factor here. If every bankruptcy, if you took the petitioner's argument, every bankruptcy would be an acknowledgement of a debt getting you outside of bankruptcy and defeats the entire purpose of bankruptcy.
How do you calculate the running on the statute of limitations?
I think I calculated from 2000 when she stopped making payments. Because at that point, I think she indicated, first of all, she talked to an attorney and says, hey, you've paid everything. She's paid $17,000 at that point. She stopped making payments. Her attorney told her to stop doing it. But at the very least, it's 2003 when she filed bankruptcy. Because it's very clear in bankruptcy law that a debt cannot survive bankruptcy without a reaffirmation agreement. Now, counsel is correct that a reaffirmation agreement would only get personal liability back on her, but they still have the lien against the property. Okay, well, 2003 is your time period. You had 9 years, six years from that date till 2009 to take action, and they didn't. And all indications on her part saying, I'm not going to have anything to do with you at this point. I want nothing to do with you. I paid you. My lawyers told me to quit paying. Counsel would like to say that when she had an attorney, the attorney would have advised her that had you still owed that debt and had you not wanted foreclosure to happen, you sign a reaffirmation agreement and go to the judge in the federal court and have them sign off on it as well, which is the requirements. So I believe that 2003 at the very earliest is when the statute of limitations would run, at least on foreclosure of the property. And of course, the last issue that we have on statute of limitations is she passed away, and then 25 months after she passes away, beyond the 2-year statute of limitations, they file a claim and they start taking action at that point. You know, they say that there's this concern that, you know, we're going to wait until she passed away and then we'll take action. They only took action 2 years after she passes. Why not take action before that? They didn't take action.
When did they take action in relationship to the commencement of a probate proceeding?
25 months after. Is that what you're asking? I'm sorry.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, they filed their claim in the probate 25 months after she passed.
And was there an appropriate notice to creditors sent to them?
I'm not quite sure, Your Honor, because I didn't handle the probate aspect of it. I can't answer that question clearly. I do know from the record that there were some concerns, according to Mr. Wolf, that he asked about probate, and supposedly the family said they weren't going to do it. But to me, that's not a relevant factor. Actually, what's more relevant factor is he had 2 years from her day of passing to take action.
Go ahead.
And regardless of, no matter who the creditor is, the 2 years runs no matter what. So it didn't matter when they started a probate or when he...
The notice to creditors, you have a shorter period.
It would cut down a shorter period of 30 days if you send notice, but at the very longest, he has 2 years, and he didn't take any action in the 2-year period.
Wasn't one of the issues the fact that there were multiple liens on this property?
Yeah, I believe there were some other liens, and I don't know the exact nature of those. It's something to do with the state of Washington, but the fact is there is actually equity in this property beyond those liens, which brings in the concern for Mr. Wolf, which is why he's making claims. But he could have known this information at the time, and when the family said, we're not going to do a probate, he could have taken action at that time, but he didn't. He sat tight. I think he understood, well, I don't want to make a reference to what he is, but I don't believe that he handled himself properly and taken action. If his intent was always to wait until she passes and then he waits until 2 years later, once the family starts taking action in a probate. There's no other questions for the court. Thank you.
Your Honor, first I'd like to address the 2-year statute of limitation. In our brief, RCW 1141.35 doesn't contain the same prohibition. In fact, you don't even have to file a claim. As long as you're a secured creditor, you can execute on your claim as you would under normal circumstances.
So was your effort one to foreclose against the property?
Yes, that's all that's been done. There's nothing to go after. The estate's insolvent, as far as I know, reviewing the schedules. And also, there was a reference to there's no evidence of any payments. Well, that was because there was a forbearance agreement. And if you look at CP 080, the Schedule J, the current expenditures of individual debtors, Ms. Harrington states in 2003 that she doesn't have a home mortgage payment or pay rent. It's zero.
Isn't that consistent with what's been represented, that she already paid the money that was owed to your
client? That's a typical debtor argument. I paid $17,000. Yeah, you paid $17,000, but interest was accruing, and the debt was more than $17,000, and that's what our accounting shows.
What evidence is there in the record that the decedent agreed to the proposed forbearance described in your client's letter?
She didn't move out of the house. She stayed there for nearly 18 years.
Okay, that fact is equally consistent with having paid off the debt, isn't it?
But if you see, look at the accounting that we prepared that was submitted for the record, it itemizes every payment, and there has never been any objection made to that statement. And it shows that there is a balance due.
The only evidence you've described that shows agreement to forbearance is that she stayed there. Is that it?
And the letter from Mr. Wolf to the effect that he wasn't going to foreclose on her as long as she lived there.
That would be evidence of his position. What evidence is there of her position with respect to forbearance besides staying in the house?
Besides staying in the house, perhaps she thought that being Don Wolf's mother, that he would be generous with her and allow her to do so.
She thought doesn't describe evidence. What evidence is there?
There's no evidence that I can think of in that respect, other than the fact that she stated in her Schedule J that she didn't need to make any house payments. Would be under oath, stated clearly, at or about the time she executed the statement of intention that indicated that the debt would be reaffirmed. And although it wasn't, it was an acknowledgement in the sense that the debt was still in existence and needed to be reaffirmed. Thank you.
Our next case this morning is Sterling Savings.